This is Aaron Hayworth interviewing Gary Carden for the Southern Oral History Program. Today is February 28, 2014, and we're here in the Love House on Franklin Street. Gary, I'd like to start off by asking you where you're from and a little bit about that.
Okay. I'm from Burlington, North Carolina, originally grew up there. And I started coming to Chapel Hill in 1964. And that's where Burlington Industry started. And it's, in its own way, it's a pretty hostile community. People don't really realize it, but because of the hosiery and the clothes that are made there or used to be made there, people are very self-conscious of what they look like and how they look. And I may not be a good example of that today, but that's the way it is. And Chapel Hill, one of the first things that appealed to me about Chapel Hill that I can remember is how laid back people looked. They looked like they lived in their clothes for 3 days versus something starched. And
compared to Burlington.
And that look has, gone around the world now.
Well, can I ask you, while we're just getting background information, a little to tell me a little bit about your family and kind of family you came out of.
Oh, God. I don't know if I can deal with that one. Background, family-wise, my mother, father were from two different walks of life. She's born more into aristocratic kind of lifestyle, and his lifestyle founded the Holiness Church in Durham. It was a little different form of sophistication. Mm-hmm. But,
So did you grow up?
He was a minister.
Your father was a minister.
Yeah. And, he started with Billy Graham and Oral Roberts when they were on the circuit of tent revivals. And that was how they all started. So it wasn't no reflection towards them, Mr. Graham, Mr. Roberts, but as far as my father went, he was a fairly programmed person, where his mother, which lived about a block away from Duke Gardens, at that time on Anderson Street, maybe a block and a half, told him from, probably ever since he could hear, he was born to be a minister. So, that wasn't in the fortune cookies, but they made it that way. And it caused him a lot of problems, because when he would go out on the platform or stage or whatever you call it to do his ministry, he and a couple other guys, ministers, deacons, however, would have a couple shots of whiskey to get the Holy Spirit going. So a little bit later, he discovered he was an alcoholic. And which runs in our family. And he did not know how to, I don't think, deal with it. He thought it was more of a curse from God or a test from God, like he was Job from the Bible, that had to have the bulls and had to do this and do that. So every time he had a hangover, he felt he was being punished. And I just think he had too many shots of whiskey. Mm-hmm. So he got crisscrossed there, left, right brain confusion.
Yeah. And he was a pastor the whole time you were living?
Most of the time. And he did a few other jobs along the way. But that was his that was his thing.
And what about your mother?
She did what you call full fashion hosiery, and which is called, excuse me, looping, where you take the and put socks together or hosiery together. Mm-hmm. And most people don't realize that mills like that, how spotless they were. Things you hear about mills are dirty and this and that. Well, that's not the way it was with us or them. I don't know if they had polyurethane at that time, like they do on basketball floors, but they were highly polished. You could almost see your face on the floor. Mm-hmm. And the women were very Chanel looking. And they sit there and they, you know, did their looping, which is like a surround circle about the size of a large platter with hundreds of needles on it.
So both of your parents worked the whole time?
Oh, yeah.
And whenever we talked on the phone, you told me about that you came out at a very young age, 13, I think you said. So how did the community, how did your parents deal with that?
Well, we went into OUT at that time. You did what you did and you covered it up.
So it wasn't overt.
No. Everything was very, you get the hell beat out of you.
Yeah.
Or you get sent to hell. But I think inherently parents know that's part of their nature, is to sense out certain vibes or whatever. But my sister got married at a young age to get away from home. And plus I guess she was, you know, thought she was in love, whatever that may be at that time. I think it changes with the weather. And she moved to High Point, which was the furniture capital of the world at that time, or at least this country. And so I went up a few weekends to visit, and we catched the bus. I took a friend with me, named Jerry, and we lived a few blocks apart. And we get the bus, go to High Point, and stay with her and her husband for a couple of days. And her next door neighbor, we met out in the yard. His dog came over in the yard, and he came out calling his dog, and he, you know, introduced him, we all met. So that night we stayed up to like 12 or 1 o'clock, which was pretty late for that age. And at that time, now maybe different, but in the middle of the conversation, or a certain point of the conversation, he said, "Are you gay?" And I said, "What's that mean?" He said, "You know." I said, "Oh, I do." "Well, I think I know what you mean, and maybe so." I said, "You know, tell me a little more." And he explained what was going on with people. And so it's sort of like opened up a whole new world of thinking for me, because growing growing up the way I grew up, and I think the way a lot of people grow up, is feeling like they are wrong or they are I guess that's the best way to put it, doing something not right. And I thought, And he said, well, I'm going to a party next weekend. Can y'all come back up? And he said, it's going to be in Sedgefield Country Club, which is a pretty neat area between High Point and Greensboro. And he had a sugar daddy. He told me what a sugar daddy was. And he was a retired vice president of Chase and Manhattan Bank. And a party it was. Everybody was very respectful. There was no one that did anything disrespectful to each other. And of course, I guess how much alcohol you consumed was how much disrespect you were doing to yourself. I think everybody there was pretty much into martinis. So I had my first martini then. And there was a guy there, I shouldn't say names too much, but I can refer to him as Stan. And he looked like Elizabeth Taylor. Beautiful man, beautiful. Too pretty to be a guy. And he was a drag queen. And he asked me to help him get in drag. So I helped put him together. And that was my first experience with any kind of cosmetology or beauty work. Outside, maybe putting lipstick on the bathroom when I was looking. And so, it just all started happening, and it was a fantastic event. People were very well-to-do. Lots of alcohol, horses, and quite an event. And I'll call the vice president, which was, it's okay to say his name, not total name, but Red. We called him Red. He liked to go to this black nightclub in Greensboro. And in those days, they didn't check your ID. If you had the courage to go in, they didn't question you on an ID level. And I was always pretty much 6'4", from probably the 8th grade on, 7th grade even.
So what age were you at this time?
All this is at the same time, around 13.
Around 13 years old?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And I went into a black nightclub, the Shirelles, Ike and Tina Turner, whole crew appeared there in Greensboro. And they were fabulous entertainers. And we were always roped off, red carpet treated, fabulous. Nobody bothered us, somebody, you know, and, you know, it just didn't happen. But it did happen because that's, you know, what happened. And so that was sort of my introductory to that part of gay life experiences. And from there, you know, it's all history.
Yeah. So, what was it that brought you to Chapel Hill originally?
There was a gay bar here that one of our congressmen owned, Nick Galifianakis, called the Tempo Room. Mm-hmm. And his brother Pete ran it. And it was up on Franklin. The structure is still there. That I think it's probably, they serve probably drinks and sandwiches now. Clothing store above it was called Town and Campus. I'm not sure the exact address, but it was about pretty much a few doors down from Alexander Julian's store. And you go down stairs, and around 10 o'clock, straight people would start leaving. Why it worked that way, I don't know. I guess the biorhythm of life at that time. And gay people started coming in. It was what we called a stand-up bar, a gene bar. So you just hung out, stood around, drank beer until they ran you out. And how they ran you out, Pete Galifianakis would take a bottle of ammonia and pour on the floor and make you gag for breath, and you got the hell out of there. And that was, you know, nobody wanted to leave.
Yeah, so you could tell how the business owners were treating you. They wanted you there to buy stuff from them.
Well, they had to protect a license.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of an abusive way to get people to leave, but it was probably, you know, crisscross. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
So that's what first brought you to Chapel Hill.
It was a tempo room.
But when did you move here?
Moved here in 1970.
Mm-hmm. And was that, did you start the business as soon as you came?
Well, when I went, my father would have killed me if I had gone to cosmetology school, so I went to a barber school. It was more masculine, and he could do it, me being a barber instead of a hairdresser. And I don't know what the difference is that much, but yet I do. You know, it's like there is a difference in the way they cut hair. But, excuse me, I went to barber school, and when I was in barber school, they tried to get me or throw me out twice. They said, "You're wasting your time and your money. You know, what are you doing here?" Because I couldn't. I saw everything my way, and my way is not their way, and so couldn't figure out what I was doing, you know, how I was cutting hair, or why are you doing this, you're supposed to do this and that. So I got out of barber school and did my apprenticeship in Burlington, and the barbers that I worked with in a barbershop told my boss that if he kept me, they were all going to quit because I was getting all the business. They wanted to get rid of me. People liked my work. And I started one of the types of haircutting that's known as shags haircut at that time, layering and shagging the hair. And it was just something very intuitive, like you would sit down and play the piano by ear. I had no background to be able to do it, but I could just do it. And I became pretty well known. And I thought, well, I'm going to get the hell out of Burlington. I can't deal with this anymore. And so I came to Chapel Hill looking for a place that I might want to be, work, rent, whatever. There was a barbershop called Carolina Barbershop, and another guy named Red happened on it. And we were two doors down from the Varsity Theater. And I went in, I said, you know, I'm looking for a place to do what I do. No one, very few people were getting haircuts, hardly at all, maybe once a year, 2 years. It was Flower Child, hippie day, you know, they just sat there all day. He said, well, you can't do anything but help. He said, you can't do anything to hurt business because it's so off anyway. So he brought me through the shop and went to the back. It was a pretty large space width-wise. And they had partitioned off an area in the back that a guy named Mr. Joseph had done and opened a beauty salon back there a few years earlier. And he left there and went down and rented something upstairs down near the post office. So I rented that space and it boomed. You know, it just skyrocketed.
This was the late 60s or the 70s?
This was 70s.
1970.
Uh-huh. And I was always treated much better by Duke clientele, Duke University, than Carolina. I had a pretty good business from the Carolina community, but it was a different form of clientele from Duke. They were used to something maybe more my style, I don't know, mm-hmm. but they came over and did a story on me, and business just went to the roof.
This was still while you were on Franklin Street.
Mm-hmm. We were there about 20-some years.
Yeah. Before we move on, could you give me the name of where you went to barber school?
Well, when I first started at barber school, I went to Columbia, South Carolina, and I guess the name of it was Columbia Barber School. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, I went there with three other gay buddies who we used to all party together, and they all wanted to do something together, so I went. Yeah. And so I started a school there. Then I, my sister became a hairstylist 2 years before I did, and I'd watch her work, so I was highly influenced by what she was doing. Mm-hmm. But I had to do it my way. You know, it was like,
and for men at that time?
Predominantly, but I went to barber school not just for men, but mm-hmm. because so my father would let me approve, go. Yeah, approve. But women started coming in the barbershop, and it started changing everything. Mm-hmm. And at the time, they called it unisex. So I'm one of the first people in the country that pioneered the integration of the male and female hair salon. It just happened.
And that happened while you were on Franklin Street.
Well, it started happening when I was doing my apprenticeship in Burlington.
Oh, yeah.
But it really boomed when I got to Chapel Hill. Mm-hmm. And it changed the economy. It changed, it changed the economics of grooming. You know, groom people like you groomed animals. Yeah. You know, it's like, do what? It changed, everything went from $3, $4 a haircut to $12,
$25,
$30. Yeah. And so it started changing the economics of my industry. And so I helped boost the economy in North Carolina, as well as God knows how many other places that influenced. Design, I'm a natural designer, or I call myself a stylist. It's a form of osmosis. You just sort of know. You're around people, you see things, and you absorb whatever it is that you see on the intelligent level that you do it on. I call it osmosis. And you come out with your results. And I just sort of knew, I knew what to do. Yeah. I just knew how to do it.
And at that time, did you seek out serving the gay community as a hairstylist?
No.
Or did they seek you?
Chapel Hill was pretty liberal, if I can use that term properly, in the 60s and 70s in gay life. Actually, the first gay dancing bar was in Chapel Hill, out towards Southern Village, across the road from Southern Village down a little dirt road. That dirt road's still there, and I may go down it again and see what's there. It was a cinder block building. They charged you 75 cents to get in the door. There was a jukebox, and they sold beer, and you could dance as long as you wanted to. And that was the first dancing bar in North Carolina. But the Tempo Room is probably, that was not a dance bar, that was a jean bar, stand-up bar. Mm-hmm. But the first bar that I ever went to was the General Green in Greensboro with this crew I met in High Point. And one of my buddies, well, I probably shouldn't mention names on that, but anyway, his father was one of the top five Klansmen in America. And we were sitting in the General Green together, and he was gay as hell, you know, we all were. Having a great time, and they, Ku Klux Klan was marching down Elm Street on the bar, and we had to run out the back door.
Yeah. And at that time,
is this connecting for you?
Yeah, this is all coming. I was going to ask you to tell that story again. I think you'd mentioned it on the phone.
About what, the KKK?
Yeah, in Greensboro. And at that time,
Well, I hope they're all dead now so they won't kill me.
Yeah, well, was that something that you had to deal with often, or was that just in Greensboro?
No, it was just happened. Mm-hmm. You know? I never experienced the KKK. I mean, you know, it's like people, you know. I mean, the White House was KKK. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover got dragged by his mom and asked questions to himself what he should do. He arrested every gay person and killed so many people to take the attention off of him. So the whole world was more fucked up than it is now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to ask you, going back to your...
I'm not sure what the KK is. They were probably drag queens that like sheets. High cotton, baby.
Well, I wanted to go back talking about your business. When you were on Franklin Street, you were just doing a chair in someone else's store, right?
Well, I had the space I rented, the barbershop, it's called Carolina Barbershop, and about, you go in, a little bit less, more than half of it, there was a petition put up with a swinging door, like a Dutch door, and it was probably twice the size of this room in the back. So.
And that was all your space?
Mm-hmm.
And did you have anybody helping you out?
Well, when I first opened, no, but then I started hiring.
Mm-hmm. Well.
And then I trained.
Mm-hmm. With the people that you were renting from, or just people that you had to do business with, I mean, banks and everything, would you say that you were ever, people try to take advantage of you or put you at a disadvantage because of
how much? I think they were highly entertained.
By you?
Mm-hmm. No, I didn't know. I know.
Nobody was trying to put you at a
disadvantage. Capitol Hill was always very good.
Very good to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. And I already asked you about gay people coming to you to have their hair done. At what time did it seem like people were okay to come in and try to get a haircut, maybe for a woman to try to seem more masculine or to perform their sexual identity a little bit more through their appearance?
Well, you're a very good question, but people didn't think that way necessarily then.
Mm-hmm.
People wanted a haircut.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could have been a kangaroo, and if I knew how to cut hair, they would come in and pay me. They didn't look at it as whatever. And gay people, I mean, it wasn't like, oh, this is the gay business or this is gay guy or whatever. You know, you snooped around and you checked people out and you did what you do. But, like I said, gay life didn't start in the tempo room until 10 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
So no one was really going to be that gay during the daytime.
Yes, people weren't political, they were just social.
Yeah, I mean, you kept it private.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain countries, whole countries, millions of people, they're more gay, they're more married men that are gay than there are single. Yeah. They get married, they do the routine, and they go out and do their thing, and they're not questioned. Mm-hmm. And in certain countries, you don't question a man. Because they, you know, are worse than they are here.
Yeah, and so some of the interviews I've listened to have been with UNC students and about being in the Carolina Gay Association, and they like to think of themselves as more political. Would you say that you were political during that time, or?
I probably did more for the gay community in North Carolina than anybody ever has done. And I'll tell you why in a minute.
You can tell me right now.
Flip it off for a second. What?
You were going to tell me how you've changed the world.
Well, I helped change the economy, and never got any kind of recognition for it or any salute at all, which didn't make me happy. And if the president raises minimum wages $1.25, it's outraged around the world, and I changed it by billions of dollars. And the cosmetology, the beauty barbering industry, is probably one of the top five, seven top industries in the world, because people spend money because they're not happy with what they look like to begin with. And that's their problem, not mine. What am I going to say? So in that sense, yes. And I helped to open, I want to say open, there was a man and woman and daughter came here from Miami in the 70s, where Trader Joe's is at now. It used to be Southern Seasons, and it was before they moved in there. And it was a building there, Mom and Pop's Ham House, and they put a bar there called the Electric Company. And the dance floor was pretty good size, and it blinked, psychedelic kind of stuff. Not psychedelic, but, you know, flashlights. And people in Chapel Hill don't go for that in those days. I don't think they go for it now or what. But they were going bankrupt. And I approached them and said, listen, do you want me to make you rich? That's what we came here for. I said, okay, let's turn your bar gay. And I had a lot of influence in North Carolina at the time, and we turned it gay, and over probably 2,500 people showed up on every night, and it took off incredible. So politically, maybe the Galifianakis is throwing that ammonia around influenced what I did. I don't know, but it changed a lot of stuff.
So you were more political by changing the economy, by changing
I don't get up and give a speech, or, you know, actions speak louder than words, my mom used to say. You want something done, you do it yourself, and monkey see, monkey do, and it was just chain reaction. And I didn't know how to give a party. I used to give them a lot. And so, I mean, it wasn't even a problem to do. But to probably try to recreate something like that now, there's no way. I mean, the internet's taken over. People probably don't even patronize the bars like they used to.
So that was in Greensboro, right?
What, the Electric Company? No, right down here at Eastgate. Right here in Chapel Hill.
Is that still open?
Trader Joe's has got it.
Okay.
Don't let me lose you now.
Okay, yeah, I was just trying to.
We're talking about 1976, 75.
Okay. And so, one thing that I've heard from some other people is that gay bars came and left from Chapel Hill, like some of them moved to Durham. Has that been your experience?
Well, you had the Tempo Room on Franklin. You had the Ponderosa from across the street from Southern Neighbor, down a little dirt road. Then you had the Pegasus, which is now the Cave, and the Courtyard used to be a dirty bar. Are you with me?
I'm with you.
There were three bars in Chapel Hill over a period of a few years. Now, the Electric Company started making some unwise decisions. This was one of the Eastgate. And I got very frustrated with my lifestyle in North Carolina. I felt like it owed me, or I deserved more of something. What, I don't know, recognition? Or, But I got sort of, it became too repetitious. You know, you get tired of a pair of shoes, you buy a new pair of shoes. So I went to New York and rented an apartment, and I was going to do my work there and leave Chapel Hill. And at that time, I went, rented an apartment, and told the electric company people that I would, you know, consult with them whenever. Well, they had gotten pretty well to do, and they got in their own trip. They got in their own sidetrack. They had no experience in what they were doing to begin with. And through my guidance or direction, and I asked five other gay guys to help us direct what they did, it sort of fell apart, and they started doing what they wanted to do. And they hired two guys that were lovers. One was a drag queen who thought he was Barbara Streisand, and the other one was a DJ. And they were just very distasteful. And they started messing up stuff. And it got very discombobulated. And so then they talked the owners into hiring this other set of lovers who worked there for about a year, and they plotted and opened up what was called Blueberry Hill, a gay bar across the street from where South Square used to be, before it was South Square, and took the business. And then from there, they went downtown Durham and opened what's called the Power Company, which was the old Rose's store, I think. And they were vicious gay guys. I mean, they were nasty people. And they cut your throat. And very unpleasant environment.
So you didn't go to Durham at that time?
Well, I was living in New York most of the time.
Oh, you were in...
I commuted.
Okay.
I was here 2 weeks, New York 2 weeks.
And you did business in New York mm-hmm. at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, because we had heard that from some people that it seemed like gay bars left Chapel Hill and then more and more people were going to Durham for
nightlife.
They
didn't leave, they were running out of business.
Yeah, and, well, to the outsider who might not know the business going on behind it.
Well, the Pegasus guy got AIDS and died.
Oh.
Nick Galifianakis and Pete, they just sort of faded out of the picture. Well, actually, it burned down. Call them fire, come to think about it. And they went down the street, across the street from the post office, where the martini bar is, and there's a downstairs bar, and they called, opened the bar there, the tempo room, and they called it the temporary. And they were going to redo the bar uptown. And that's when we opened up the electric company. And that was, well, it was already open, excuse me. It was known as the electric company. And so I just turned it gay for them.
Uh-huh.
And I had some very, very influential, I was a pretty popular person, you know, whatever that is. A lot of people watched me or thought about me and whatever. And I got around, and I had a few other buddies that were pretty, I guess we could say, outrageous. And if we said jump, everybody was jumping. And not meaning that in a rude way, but you got to have somebody directing the show.
Mm-hmm.
And we just sort of fell in that role. And I was in Charlotte, Greensboro. And so, you know, the word spread. You tell 10 gay people in Charlotte something today, the whole town's going to know it by tomorrow in the gay community because mm-hmm. the word spreads pretty quick. And there was no white rabbit at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you know, what it was. So politically, just by living my life and doing what I felt right to do has had a great effect on the community
mm-hmm.
of gay life in North Carolina. And then when I first went to New York, you know, I was going to the Stonewall before it was ever raided. You know what the Stonewall is?
I'm not familiar.
You know, look it up. Google the Stonewall. Mm-hmm. That started the whole gay revolution.
Okay. So, in the gay social scene, did the bars cater to permanent residents and students alike? Was everybody intermingling together? Or was it like if a student should... I'm just asking about
the... No, I'm listening.
The composition of people going out, was it students and then people that also permanently lived in the area?
Chapel Hill is a pretty transit community, period. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at 5 years, 10 years, people come and go. I think I understood the question, but...
So there was there a different scene for students than there were for faculty, business owners, regular residents of Chapel Hill, Durham? Did those two
That's
crowds...
a good question. Because I didn't go to UNC. Mm-hmm. I graduated from high school.
Yeah.
That was it. Yeah, I went to barber school and did my stuff.
Yeah.
So I was at the age of being a student, and all my buddies when I first started coming to Chapel Hill were UNC people.
Yeah.
So I was in a student lifestyle at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think most businesses, if you had a dollar in your pocket and you all ordered a vanilla ice cream, they didn't have any reason not to give it to you.
Yeah.
And we didn't even have Redmond's. You know what Redmond's is?
Yeah, the restaurant.
They were even open.
Yeah.
They weren't heard of. The building that they bought and up in Redmond's in used to be what was called the Burger King. Uh-huh. Which never made anything anyway. It was one of the weaker chains. We didn't have a restaurant open after 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. There was no place to go.
Yeah.
So you had to have people over and get to the grocery store early if you wanted something to happen, you know,
yeah.
Food-wise. But so with my business, and I named my business Hair Unlimited, we had probably as many professional people that worked and lived here as we did students.
Yeah.
And maybe even more. I had the whole basketball team at Duke here at one time.
Oh yeah, and you did their hair? Was that
nobody could cut hair.
Yeah. Was that at the
now there's more competition, people learn. You got more Michael Jordans now under 21.
Yeah.
But when he was here, there was only one Michael Jordan. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
People evolve.
So when you cut the...
I think.
When you cut the Duke basketball team's hair, was that at a time where it was...
Well, they didn't come in as a team.
I mean, yeah.
Word got passed.
Yeah. Was that mostly white team at the time?
I should have brought my portfolio. We'll meet again. I'll show you my portfolios. Yeah. Knock your socks off. So.
Yeah, because I know you were doing men and women, but did you service the African American community?
Not that many people, not really many black people contacted me. I've had a few black clients along the way, but I wasn't raised doing ethnic hair.
Mm-hmm.
And my philosophy is that you do what you're raised to do. In that sense, and I don't have black hair.
Yeah.
Very different, very different.
Yeah.
And I can style it and I can change their look and say, okay, they'll find you a good person to keep it up.
Yeah.
But, and they can precisionize it, but I was never raised to do it that much. I had a few black friends, and a few people came in, but
yeah, because I just
never
think,
that many.
When you think of basketball teams now, I mean, it's different. They're much more integrated now than in the 70s, correct?
Well, from what I remember, sure.
At that time, the Duke basketball team was mostly white, right?
You know, that's a good question.
Yeah.
I don't. I'm trying to place a few of them.
That's all right.
It was probably pretty mixed.
Yeah. So, you said that a lot
I had one of the UNC football players. He was gay, and he was black. As a client for many years. And he was the first gay athlete that probably ever came out at UNC.
Who was that?
His name, well, I don't know if I should say his name.
Well, if he was out.
Huh?
What degree of out?
Well, he just let the community know he didn't give a shit, he was gay.
Yeah.
His name was Judge Maddox. Beautiful man, damn. You know, but I could have a sexual relationship better than I could style his hair. That's the way I'm out of deep. So, that's, you know, there's some good questions. I don't really remember that much about what they were about, gay, I mean, black or white. It was a mixture in those days to a certain point. I'm trying to remember. I'll look it up.
Yeah.
I'll check into that.
Yeah. So you said a lot of your close friends when you were starting out were UNC people. How did your relationship with UNC students change over time as you've been here? Because they were further and further removed from your age.
Well, when I came into Chapel Hill, I moved right into the age group I was at, and they were all, you know, pretty much UNC students. All but a few professors that were gay at the time. And the Duke, the Duke crew was, like I said, Duke was always more. I hung out more with Duke people than I did UNC, even though my immediate friends were UNC. Mm-hmm. But as a whole, there were more Duke people. And one of the guys came in, got his hair, the Duke. I don't remember his name, I can sort of see his face. He was white. And he said, "Gary, I have a friend hitting on me. He's my housemate." And he said, "He's gay. And I'm, you know, I don't want this to happen. I want to hurt our friendship. And I'm not going to let anything happen." He said, "Can you help me?" I said, "Sure. And we'll have a cocktail party on Friday night." And put a bottle of whiskey out and invite people over. And he came, Jim McIntyre. I can say his name. Give me a minute. So Jim came over with his friend at the party. I said, Jim, he never met me. I said, I'm gonna cut your hair. He said, you should get alive. He said, okay. And what was this about? And so we went to the bar, which I had been responsible for, turning it, integrating it gay. And Jim started, I mean, he got into it real quick and left his roommate alone. Is that, were we on camera too?
No, not.
Just some time, okay. So, as if we are, I'll put on some lipstick or something, something fancy. So he started the Durham Arts Council. And Miss Mary Duke Biddle Siemens, do you know who I'm speaking of?
Who?
Mary Duke Biddle Siemens.
I don't know of her.
Okay, look her up.
Okay. Okay.
She fell in love with Jim because of what he did for Durham. And Miss Duke is was one of the richest women in the world. Duke, okay?
Yeah.
And her first cousin, their fathers were brothers, was Doris Duke.
Uh-huh.
You know who she is? Mm-hmm. Damn, you need to learn some of this stuff. Right. I guess this is what it's about. Well, Miss Siemens basically, she's multi-dimensional. She had a house a block long across the street from the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. A whole block. Wow. That was her house in New York. Okay. She did a lot of stuff. And meaning she was very influential, an achiever beyond belief. She was a queen. And she was friends with Isaac Stern. Do you know the name? And he ran Carnegie Hall. You heard the name? Okay. And they needed a director to raise them $55 million for Carnegie Hall to be refurbished.
Yeah.
And she recommended Jim McIntyre to do it. And Jim was from Siler City or either Sanford, I think it's Siler City. At the time, A&B country. And he took the job, and Miss Simmons flipped the switch, it happened. Carnegie Hall in Durham. He was hired, he got the job, he raised $55 million. And he found out he had HIV. And he was dealing with that transition at the time that Carnegie Hall had sort of a political change. It's like Democrats and Republicans, that whole director change of officers. And with the officers, they shifted. They wanted a new director. So Jim left and went to what was called the Big Apple Circus. Have you heard of the Big Apple Circus? Google it. And he directed that for a couple of years. And then Bette Midler hired him to be her manager to do a program in New York, what's called Clean Up New York, and it's still going on. And she spends millions a of dollars for the streets of New York. And that's when he died. And then I went to San Francisco. And
that's the, I think you told me about this, the accident.
Yeah. So I commuted San Francisco, New York, and Chapel Hill, of all places. This was home. And so anyway, hard to remember some of this stuff.
Yeah.
I just got out of the hospital. Mayor Moscone and Harvey Milk were assassinated. It's like, and well, I have a penthouse in San Francisco. It wasn't like a real penthouse, but it was a penthouse. It was a pre-earthquake house where they had taken the attic and redid it, and we were at the second highest point in the city. I mean, thousands of people hit the street. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And one of my clients in San Francisco wrote the book, The Hospice Movement, and introduced it to America. I got killed on the bridge, rebirthed. Moscone and Milk were assassinated, and she wrote the book on the hospice movement, and the AIDS epidemic hit. So we're talking some political shit.
Yeah.
But yet, you know, I went to a round table or a square table like this, voting if we should have leaf blowers blowing at 9 o'clock in the morning or not. I could give a fuck. I'm talking about real shit.
Can you tell, you just mentioned that you got in the accident. Can you tell me a little bit more about what that was like?
Oh, Lord. Excuse me for laughing. It was such an innocent question.
Yeah, I know you said that you were...
I remember driving onto the bridge, which was sort of a habit because I did it all the time anyway. I lived in San Francisco. My studio was in Marin County. 17 miles. Mm-hmm. Crossed over the Golden Gate Bridge, which is part of the 17 miles. You come into Marin County in Sausalito. Her Sausalito is here. You go around Sausalito and you come to Tiburon. That's where I was at. And Mill Valley's over here. And then you go into Napa Valley down here. So, got off work. A friend of mine, I've eaten a lot of seafood today, so I hope in my car I should get some Altoids. I had to go to the airport, so I went across the bridge a couple times and brought her in. And her name is Marion Starnes, Reverend Starnes. Am I losing you?
No.
Okay. She's one of the top psychics in the world. And she's probably about 85 now. I lost contact with her because I couldn't deal with much of it anymore. She had her pathway to go in and I had mine. But I sponsored her for a lot of programs and she helped the gay community tremendously. and you know, she was well received and vice versa. And we were sponsoring her for a program in San Francisco. So in my studio, I had one partner, Jordan, and she liked the way he did her hair. And he did her hair a certain manner that I wasn't that interested in doing. And he was from the old school of cosmetology. And he was good at it. He's still good at it. And so I said, you know. So anyway, picked her up, brought her over to Tiburon, did her looks, took her over to eat, and coming back, I was driving across the bridge. A dentist man who lived in Sausalito, worked his office in San Francisco, fell asleep, crossed over the bridge, which is the medium, hit the edge of the bridge, landed on top of me, and I went out for 3.5 weeks. And when I woke up, they put me there to die. And my sister was with me. She flew out the next morning. And so to describe what the wreck was like, whatever went on, I don't know. I still get side effects from it in different ways, which I don't need to go into at times. But it activates certain things from my childhood, I think. But it took 8 years to form my eye and hand coordination back to be and do what I do.
So at that time, did you...
8 years.
Yeah, at that time, what did you do? Did you still do work, or did you have to...
Well, I had a few pennies put away.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of friends. I started doing what I did.
Yeah.
And people just dealt with a bad haircut. Well, you're doing pretty good there. But even one of my bad haircuts is better than most people's good ones, so... I was okay with it. I'm a little cocky there, but no, I'm very humble.
You are called the guru of style, is that?
I've been blessed.
I saw that on the website, the guru of style.
It was nice. It was nice. But you know, anyway.
Yeah.
So I've been very blessed, you know, and I'm still here.
Yeah, and you're still working in your salon.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I'll have you over sometime. You see this?
Do my hair?
Do your hair? We'll bleach it white, and or maybe a sort of a beach blonde. Give you a little shift there.
Younger.
But no, I won't worry about that one. You have to show ID now. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know what else.
We've covered a lot of
territory.
Yeah, a lot of good stuff.
Well, if you want to listen to this and da da da. And pick back up on it if we missed anything or fill in any gaps.
Yeah, well, do you have anything that you want to say about maybe how... I think it's good to get the perspective of how you think things have changed in Chapel Hill, which they have drastically. I don't know if you have any just general
things
thoughts
in Chapel Hill or gay life in Chapel Hill?
Yeah, gay life, the culture, just the way things are different now. Kind of a loaded question.
That's okay. With my experience, I'm pretty loaded myself. I think the interview is good, and I think the younger gay people, whatever you want to say, need to know what the hell happened before they got here, because they didn't have a fucking thing to do with it. You know, they don't know anything about slavery. Speaking of black people, they need to know their history. Good place. And life is real bittersweet. Makes me sad, makes me happy. But Betty Davis said, aging is not for sissies, and put on your seatbelt, it's going to be a bumpy ride. Mm-hmm. What can I say? And if you wear high heels, you better make sure they fit. I don't know. I don't know what it's... I had to relearn things over to a great degree, you know, from the wreck. I could remember certain things and other things I couldn't. So I don't know what it's like to be your age or their age and looking at the world. Mm-hmm. It's like... But... It's... What would I say? I guess I said it.
All right. I think that's good.
I hope that